Hey, it's Mark, and I'm back with another episode of Finding Your Summit. And this week, I was very fortunate to have a chat with an old-time New Orleans Saint teammate. And the thing that makes Glenn Derby such a unique soul is that he was willing to share these tough times that he went through. And I didn't know at the time, even though I was friends, we did go out, that he had an alcohol problem. And he talks about it very candidly. And the things that got him through it, certainly his daughters have been the joy of his life, really helped him be the best that he can be. And now he's out doing different things, a very healthy lifestyle. And so it was really fun to get caught up with Glenn. And we just go through a lot of things, you know, the way it was in Wisconsin, which is where he grew up, to playing for the Saints, and then the struggles of being hurt and overcoming some marriages and things like that. So it is a good episode, and we do weave our way through, and there's a happy ending, which is great. And that's it. Okay, so that is Glenn. And as always, go in and rate and review on iTunes, and you want to find out more about what I'm up to, markpattisonnfl.com. Okay, so on that note, ready, hike, as they say in football. Let's go get it. Hey, everybody, it's me, Mark Pattison, back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit. And this week, I'm so pumped up because I get to chat and reminisce with an old football teammate of mine with the New Orleans Saints. His name is Glenn Derby, all the way from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, beaming back to Hermosa Beach. Glenn, how you doing?
I'm doing awesome, Mark. Thank you so much for having me on here.
Oh, man, this is great. You know, you and I have not caught up in a long time, and here we are after all these years, and I read about your story, and it was just like, you know what, I've got to have this guy in my pod. He definitely fits into the whole model of overcoming adversity and finding his way, and in fact, you have done that, and we'll get into that here in a moment, but man, I think back, you're in Wisconsin, I'm out here in California, and there's been a lot of years that have grown in between those times. I mean, 20 plus years, right, since we really last saw each other.
Absolutely. I think the last time we were together was either 88 or 89, if I remember correct. I think it was 88. I was a rookie, and you were a couple years in, and you, me, and Steve Trapillo hit it off really well and had a lot of fun that year when I was on injured reserve down in New Orleans. So got to know you real good. It's amazing how after all these years, there's some guys that I do remember periodically. And when I saw you pop up on Facebook with your mountain climbing and all the stuff you're doing, I thought, man, I would love to catch up with that dude.
Yeah. And, you know, sadly, Steve Trapillo died of a massive heart attack about 10 years ago, which was obviously awful. I roomed with him. He's a big guy from Boston College. And it's interesting because the things that we're going to get into today, which are kind of wrap around sobriety, I didn't know that there were any issues going on back in the day. And there's a memory that I'll never forget that the three of us jumped in. I think it was your car and you slipped in a track of Miller. What's his name? The Steve Miller Band.
Steve Miller Band, yeah.
Yeah, and he had his greatest hits. And we just rock and rolled all the way up to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Anna. And we went to hear a guy named Steve Azar, who's become a music star now. And I actually interviewed him about a month ago. Just really incredible. He's had a number of top 10 hits.
Wow, isn't that cool?
No, it's really cool. And it's in some cases, in his life has really thrived. We've all gone on to do different things. Unfortunately for Steve Trapillo, his journey ended years ago, and that's the way that played. But we all go through different stuff, and we talked about that with Steve Azar, and now we're here talking with you. So let's go back, and I want to set this whole thing up. And
sure.
So one of the things that really struck me, and I've found this with other people, is that growing up, you literally moved 20 different times before you were 18, before I met you. It's incredible.
It was incredible, yeah. And looking back on it, it was normal. As I look back on it, when I was going through it, it felt normal to me. And now being older and watching my daughters grow, and I was even talking to my oldest daughter, Savannah, the other day about life and in general. And I said to her, I said, Savannah, can you imagine if you went to a different kindergarten, a different first grade, second grade, third grade? The first time I went to the same school back to back year after year was in seventh grade. In all those times, we were moving different houses. So I never really got a sense of belonging in school, and it was really difficult. Now, there were some good things that happened to it because I could fit in with just about anyone, because when you're that young and you're moving around, that's what you're forced to do. The bad thing is it really kind of set me to, I guess, for lack of better words, hanging out with the rough crowd. I didn't ever feel like I could fit in with the good crowd, because I don't know if you remember back when you were in grade school, but you know, you had a group of cliques, a group of kids that you went ran around the neighborhood with and you hung out with. And if you're a new kid, typically speaking, they don't fit right in with the cliques. So you end up finding the kind of the cast out kids, the kids that didn't belong. So I got really good at hanging out with all different kinds of people. That's a good thing. The bad thing was, is it kind of set, you know, I struggled in school. I was a very bright kid, but I struggled with discipline, basic academics. Going into different math classes, science classes, et cetera, it became really challenging for me. So it did kind of set the stage for me to have a little bit of struggles as I was growing up. I look at it too, is that I see my daughters and they handle social things so beautifully. And, you know, they're not angry. They're not getting in fights. They're not having these social difficulties that I remember when I was in grade school, that was all I dealt with. So it's challenging, and I would not recommend anyone to have their kids do that.
No, there's two things that come to mind. Number one, I've got two daughters as well. And mm-hmm. the one thing that kids love is consistency, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And a stable environment. And what you just described was not a stable environment because
no.
you're bouncing all over the place. In fact, you were in Texas and Wyoming and Montana, which I want to talk about in a minute. But
yep.
I think the question that just jumps out to me is, why were you moving around so much?
Well, that's a very good question. Most people would say that I was a military brat. In fact, my mom and dad, neither one of them were in the military. Basically, Mark, to sum it up quickly, is my dad and mom, you know, and I've talked to both of them about it. My dad, unfortunately, has passed on a few years ago, but he and I talked a lot about the whole thing. And basically what it came down to was they got married mainly because they were going to be raising a family. And, you know, it was kind of the thing to do. They weren't real settled in what their career path was. My dad, he was in playing football at Duke. He was on a scholarship at Duke playing football, and he blew out his knee. Back then, it was same injury I had where they had major surgery. I didn't even have surgery. It was an MCL tear. So he was out. He was done playing, and he didn't know what he was going to do. So we were in North Carolina where I was born, and then they moved to Texas because my dad had a contact that he was going to become a paint contractor. Well, he started a business. It ended up folding after about a year or two, and that was right around when I was a kindergartner. And then they both wanted to become ranchers. I don't know, it was a dream of theirs. We moved up to Wyoming for them to start becoming ranch hands. And when Dad was working at a ranch, he got fired a couple places, and they basically said, you need to go back to school, which they ended up going to Montana State. They were going to school at Montana State. We were following all around to these different ranches. And then when they finally got to at the college, the funny thing is we originally were living in Bozeman, but it was too expensive for them. So then we ended up moving out to Belgrade. So even in a place where they were going to school, I could have stayed at that school, but we moved schools there. I lived there in that area for 4 years. Then when my dad got out, he became a school teacher. So we moved to Red Lodge, where I lived for a couple years. And then he got the calling to become a priest. And so then we moved to Wisconsin for him to go to Episcopal Seminary. And then after that, I went to Madison and then New Orleans. And then,
I got that path. You know, it's interesting because Bozeman is actually very near and dear to me. I know Montana State well, a lot of roots there. I built a ranch just outside of, actually north of Belgrade.
Oh, you're kidding me. I go out there all the time. I'll have to come and check you out.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of history there, and I've spent a zillion hours out there and running around Bozeman. And
beautiful
so it's just
area.
A
Love
beautiful
it.
Area. Yeah, yeah. It's a little chilly this time of year, but,
yeah.
you know, just the Gallatin Mountain Range that surrounds. But the bottom line, though, it sounds, not taking shots in your dad or anything, but it just sounds like he was a guy that was never really settled in what he was doing and chasing something. I'm not sure what that was. And that led to, you're in this state, in that
yep.
state, in this city, in that town. And did he ever follow through on the priesthood? And
he did. He did. And, you know, in his last 20 years of his life, he finally figured out who he was. You know, and it was interesting because I had gone through my own, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but my own recovery and issues with life. And he and I kind of almost, I think I started a little bit before he did, and then he started too. And he went through a lot of challenging stuff. And his last 20 years, though, he was pretty settled as a priest. And I think he really found who he wanted to be. I used to always say that there's a country song that says something like, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And that kind of was the way my dad was. He fell for all different kinds of things, and we'd chase all around these different pipe dreams without any substance. And so I kind of learned early on that, and it did affect me in some of my decisions that I would make as a late teenager, early in my 20s, which is when I kind of knew you. Yeah.
Yeah, no. And again, a lot of these things were masked in terms of what I knew what was going on. So let's go back, and I want to tie together kind of this string of now you're going to high school. And yep. Where was that? Was that in Wisconsin?
It was at a school called Oconomowoc, which is just a little further west than I am right now. It's basically between Madison and Milwaukee.
Okay. And for people who don't know, Glenn is, how tall are you, like 6'4"?
I'm 6'6".
Yeah, 6'6". He's a big offensive tackle. And so I'm sure that from a younger kid, you were always the taller one. You excelled at sports. I'm sure that made you popular. I mean, you're a good guy anyhow, but somewhere in there between your popularity of how good you were athletically in sports and alcohol came into play, right?
Well, alcohol came in very early for me. So when we were in Montana, my parents became kind of a party coordinator for a rodeo club. I used to ride bulls in Bronx when I was young, actually rope steers. And I was at Walt Garrison's, the rodeo that Walt Garrison got hurt that ended his career for the Dallas Cowboys. He was like my hero, and I was going to be a steer wrestler, and that was going to be me. All I could think about was that. So anyways, we're rodeoing and partying. Well,
you might be a little too tall for
that. What's
that? I'm a little too tall.
That might be. Yeah. I never scored well when I rode bulls because I looked so awkward being so tall. You know, I'm going against these little 5'5" guys that look good. But anyways, so back in those days, there was in Montana, you know, there was a lot of, in the rodeo crowd, there was a lot of tobacco chewing, beer drinking, party. Sure. Well, when I was like 13 years old, 12 or 13, me and some of the guys that I was riding with, we snuck down in my parents' basement, and they had all the beer for the parties there. And we took a couple six packs and went out in the woods and drank it. And that was the first time I got buzzed on alcohol, was at about 12 or 13. And I look at my daughter and I think, oh my God, I cannot believe, you know, she's 13. I can't even fathom that she would even think about doing something like that. So I don't know where my head was at that time, but that's kind of where the whole drinking thing started. And I remember that warm feeling. It was kind of like, I guess I look at it as at that time in my life, it was kind of like, okay, this is what God feels like, or this is what something greater than me feels like, was that warmth that just went into my body. And it kind of just took over, Mark. And so out in Montana, I'm a 7th grader, 8th grader, 9th grader.
Yep.
And out there, you get your learner's permit at 14. You get your driver's license at 15. I'm driving all over the place, and you can drive even before then on country dirt roads. So we're driving around and we're partying, smoking marijuana, drinking beer. I remember the first time I was like in 8th grade and I smoked hash for the first time. And it was just something that kind of, it became an obsession for me. When I moved to Wisconsin, I had my driver's license before anyone else had it. So I had a pickup, a big Dodge pickup with big tires on it and everything else, and had one of those caps on the back. And we used to throw a quarter barrel back there, and we'd drive all over the country drinking beer and listen to music as loud as we could. And this is when I'm a freshman in high school, sophomore in high school, I think. Yeah, sophomore. So I started very early and partied hard all the way through high school. And then, of course, I picked the University of Wisconsin, which is a huge party school, and it just continued. So, yeah.
Well, and you know the drill. I mean, if you're big like you were, you could play and get away with it. I mean, it just fuels. You think you can keep it going. You're young. You've got a lot of energy. Yep. And that only keeps up, stays with you for so long until you finally crash, right?
Yeah.
So now you get a full ride Scully to Wisconsin.
Yep.
And you're there. And how long before you started games? How many years did you have to be on scout team? Or?
Well, I was on scout team my freshman year. I was on scout team through training camp. And then the first week we got out of training camp, I ended up making it off of scout team onto the travel squad. So I traveled my freshman and sophomore year, played a few games my sophomore year, and then actually started my junior year. So that would have been my redshirt sophomore year. So I ended up starting 3 years there.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I also read something about after your junior year, you had a great year. A lot of people had you projected very highly in the draft. And then your coach suddenly died of a heart attack.
Oh, it was horrible. We had a very good coach. He was bringing Wisconsin back. We had beaten Michigan, Ohio State, started to become pretty well known, went to a bowl game. We were on our way and had a great group of guys running the typical NFL offense. And, you know, it was the two back, split back, all that, you know, the whole pro offense style. Yeah. And we were doing great. And then he passed away and our defensive coordinator.
What was his name?
His name was Dave McClain. You know, we had a spring game and it went very, very well. 3 days after our spring game, he was sitting in the sauna with a couple of the guys and ended up falling over with a heart attack at 49. Totally unexpected. So it really put kind of a turmoil into our whole program. So then my junior year, our defensive coordinator took over as the interim. We were projected to be possibly in the Big Ten, running for the Big Ten
championship.
A lot of people thought we could, yeah. And yeah, we ended up going 3-9. It was a miserable season. Hmm. Well, at that time, you know, I had talked to a few people, and there was I was rated extremely high at an offensive tackle. They wouldn't let us go out. I tried to appeal to a, what do they call that, a hardship.
Yeah.
But I got turned down. So then I had to stick it out for my fifth-year senior, and we had a coach come in that ran the veer. And what they do is they move the tackles into guards. Mm. And you know what veer is. I mean, veer's not a NFL offense by any means. And
no.
So here I am at a guard crab blocking all these guys and basically went from being a top round down to a very low round. Now I look back at it and say, you know, as far as my talent and ability, that shouldn't have mattered. I think, you know, at that time I was partying extremely hard. I was making some very poor decisions. And I think that probably had as much or more to do it with it than moving positions and switching offenses. I was not a happy guy. Coach McClain was kind of he was the dad I never had. I could go to him. He would always care about me, ask how I'm doing. He even asked about my drinking and, you know, it said he had heard that I was quite the drinker and that, you know, maybe I need to back off on it if I wanted to play in the NFL. And man, I kind of was listening to him. But when he left, it was pretty devastating, I think,
yeah,
for a lot of us.
Back to the old ways. No, I get it. Okay, so now you get drafted by New Orleans, and you come down there and you join me. And one thing that people don't – I mean, I love New Orleans, but I always say it's a great place to visit. But yeah, everything is based around food and drink and entertainment. Yeah. That's just the way the French Quarter and everything else is set up. And it's not like a Wisconsin or – LA or something where you've got so many different distractions to different things that you can go do. And so that's what a lot of people do and spend too much time on that side of it. But, you know, at the end of the day, you have to be a professional. You have to go down there. And if you don't go down there with the right drive and the right mindset, it's going to make it very challenging to make it in the NFL. It's just too competitive, as you know.
Well, and I think the other thing that happens a lot is you go from college where you have, you know, you're with a group of guys. The coaches know you really well, and all year long, you're basically having a coach tell you what to do. When you get to the NFL, there's not that. You're kind of on your own a little bit. Yeah, they're with you during the day when you're at the facility, but you're not really being kept tabs of on Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, all that kind of stuff. You're a lot freer in the NFL to do whatever you want. And if you don't have that self-discipline and you don't have people in your corner to keep you straight, you can veer way off very fast. And I think a lot of guys do, including myself. That was pretty difficult.
You're talking about accountability, right? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, and we all have to do this, and that is, right, is surrounding yourself with the right types of people who are going to enable you to make the right types of decisions. And that takes a maturity. And
absolutely,
if you don't have some of the other things, just the core basics of knowing exactly who you are, where you're going, and what you want to accomplish, it can make a lot of those things very difficult in the choices that you make. And it's a process, right? I mean, you just don't wake up and like, hey, I'm a rock star. I mean, it takes a lot of drive and having the right influences around you. And I look back and, you know, a lot of this is like, well, no wonder somebody might have had a problem if the home environment is not right. stable and consistent, and you've actually moved 20 times in 18 years. So it's really insane.
It is insane. And I think the other thing that happens too, Mark, and you knew this, is Mora runs I really respected that guy a lot, but he runs a very challenging, hard practice. And when you're fighting and practicing that hard, you've got to be in the right mind. And I know for me, I didn't have that self-discipline that was a lot of the other guys around me did. And it was really frustrating to me because I felt like I had the talent that they did. I just didn't have the ability to focus and stay in that environment on a day-to-day basis. That's pretty much when I started getting really into the pain meds to try and help me cope, because I didn't know how to cope. And I didn't know how to handle that kind of an environment with those kinds of pressures.
So you started taking Percocet? Is that right?
I actually started in college. I had surgery and they gave me Percocets, which I really liked. And then I didn't start taking them on a regular basis till probably it was towards the later end of my rookie year in New Orleans, where I started pretty regularly taking them. Yeah.
Well, as you know, it's a huge problem today.
Yes, it is.
Yep. And it just seems like it's just now really coming into the forefront of pain medication and people becoming addicted to that. I mean, no wonder, mm-hmm. right? You know, it's just like these doctors subscribe it. And the next thing you know, you're knee deep into all this and like, oh my God, how do I get out of it? It's hard. I totally get it. So now you play a couple of years in New Orleans, and I know you were hurt and you were kind of back and forth in terms of struggling through that. And then ultimately you decide to get some surgery on your ankles. What happened after that?
Well, what happened, Mark, was is you remember James Campen. I think he was there when you were there. Well, he was up in Green Bay and he called me and said, hey, Glenn, you know, we're really needing a long snapper up here. And I know you know how to do that. And I said, yeah, absolutely. And that was the first year of that Plan B free agency. So I was able to get a free agency deal up to Green Bay. Well, I came up to Green Bay to long snap because I knew my time was pretty much up. I had a hell of a time with my ankles getting ready and being in the right kind of shape. Plus, along with all the partying I was doing, it wasn't helping either. But anyway, so I came to Wisconsin to long snap. Well, the guy, I think it was Blair Bush, maybe was his name. I can't remember his name, but he was the long snapper. Yeah, for a long, long time. And he was going to retire.
He played at Washington.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I know Blair well.
Okay. So anyways, he was the long snapper. Well, he was going to retire. So I came up to replace him and was going through training camp. And he decided to not retire. He was going to play one more year. So I ended up having to actually try and make it on the team as a player. Well, camp had gotten hurt. So I was playing at center. Well, when I was doing very well at the position, they were very happy with how I was playing. And we were playing against Kansas City in one of those practices where we went to their place and practiced against them.
Sure.
And had a scrimmage, and I ended up rolling my ankle really bad. Up in Green Bay, you have to, the locker rooms are up in the stadium, and the practice field is like way over on the other side of a parking lot. So you had to walk across this parking lot. Well, you're all taped up in those big studded shoes. And I had a heck of a time walking from the stadium down to the practice field. And I kept going, wow, how am I ever going to make this? And every day I would walk down there and it would be so painful. And I'd get down there and I'd do my long snapping and then I'd have to get in and play. Well, one time we were doing a drill where it was the center was doing double read. So we were kind of learning this. This was kind of new, where centers would actually look at a middle linebacker to the outside linebacker. If the middle backer came, you stayed. If he didn't, you'd go out to the outside backer. Well, Bryce Popp came flying in, and I was kind of trying to figure it out, and I wasn't prepared for the hit, and he hit me really hard. And my whole, you know, I've had concussions and I've had dingers and all that stuff. Well, he hit me so freaking hard. I was laying on the turf, and everything was spinning. It felt like my head exploded out of my helmet. And I'm just laying there. I'm like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. This is just so ungodly painful. And walking up and down the thing, I went to Lindy Infante, and Charlie Davis was the O-line coach. And I said, listen, I'm having a hard time even walking up and down from practice to the thing. I said, I'm not giving you my best. I don't know what I can do. I need to get these ankles fixed. And basically, Lindy said, we'll shoot them up with cortisone. And we need you. This could be my last year. And we really need you to play backup center and tackle. and also be our backup long snapper. Next year, you can do our long snapping. I said, I just can't make it up and down anymore. I'm going to have surgery. And they would not do it. They said, no, we will not have surgery. So I was like, all right, screw it. I just walked out of practice. I got my truck and I drove back to my parents' house and I said, I'm done.
Yeah. You know, part of that, what you just said, is such an old school way of thinking. You know, they're not doing those things anymore. Like, right. Hey, you've got this mega injury in your ankles, your arm, your throwing shoulder, yeah, or something, and you just inject it with cortisone, and that, yeah, all it does is numb the pain. It doesn't fix the injury, and you, exactly, go back out there. Yeah. I mean, it's so insane, right?
It was,
it's
insane. Just like, there was no collective bargaining agreement. We had nothing. We had nothing we could do. So I'm like, all right, what am I going to do? Well, that's what I chose. With no advice of anybody, that was just my brain thinking, this is what I have to do. So I ended up going to Madison and having some doctors do surgery on my ankles, and I was much better. I was in great shape. I was feeling really good, probably the best I'd felt in 5 or 6 years. And I had a tryout with Detroit, so I fly out to Detroit, go through the whole medical procedure, you know, where they test you and do everything, and, sure, and I'm going to the stadium to get my gear, and I'm standing there, and he goes, no, you did not get any gear. And I'm like, oh, I don't even have to work out. This is cool. And they came down and told me that I flunked the physical because of my ankles. And I had a couple other workouts scheduled too, but at that time, when you flunk a physical, all the other teams canceled, and I was pretty much done. So that was the end, and it was abrupt. It was not under my control. It was very difficult. You know, and you know how it is when you get told you're done, and now what else are you going to do? It's a rough time, but that's how it all went down.
Yeah, no, it's literally like driving off a cliff. You've been doing something in the way you and I started back and forth to fifth grade, and you play through that, through high school, through college, and now you get into the NFL, and you've been very driven towards one particular goal. It's your love, it's your passion, and now all of a sudden, like, you're done. You can't do this thing anymore. Yep. And so where do I go? And to compound all this, I want to get your comment on this, but to compound all this, you're driving off a cliff. And at the same time, now the way that you're dealing with this, or maybe one of the ways you were dealing with this, is medicating with alcohol.
Oh, I was heavily medicating, Mark. It wasn't just one of the ways. It was the major way. I had gotten married to a lady from New Orleans. It was a rocky relationship, and she was into some other chemicals, but her and I, that was pretty much what we were doing, was medicating. Both of us were in a depression. I wasn't making any money anymore. We weren't sure what we were going to do. I crashed hard. Those next couple of years were pretty rough. And chemicals and alcohol and drinking, it was no longer fun. It was doing it to numb the pain and the disappointments, the sadness. You know, you have a dream and you're there. I mean, I was right there. I was there to be able to do this for what I thought was going to be 10 or 12 years. And now all of a sudden you're just done. It's a tough, tough, tough thing to go through.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I didn't have those issues exactly, but I did drive off the end of a cliff, and, you know, it was hard to deal with, man. I mean, it was probably 2 years for me of just like, what am I going to do now, right? And, you know, I was doing a few things and kicking tires here and there, but it was hard, and I probably wasn't the easiest person to be around at that time. So as it relates to your situation, how did you pull yourself out of this? Because I think you've now been sober for 22 years. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So there's this, you know, the whole part of finding your summit is overcoming adversity, and certainly you went through yours. And now somehow you had to elevate yourself from and hit that bottom level of, I don't want to do this anymore. I need to get better. I need to get focused. I need to, you know, there's more to life than this. And at some point in time, we all come to that kind of that moment of truth, right?
Yes. Well, for me, Mark, it was, you know, like I told you, I was in that marriage and it got really bad. I had actually tried to kill myself a couple times, drove off the road twice trying to hit a telephone pole. The second time, the car literally spun all the way around the pole. And I'm sitting there looking, I'm like, I can't even kill myself, right? And it was so desperate. I mean, I was so desperate. I didn't know what to do. I went home and my first wife was in tears and we were just really sad. And she was telling me she needed to get help and she wanted to go into treatment. And I said, all right, she found a place and I drove her down there and we went through the whole intake process of getting her in there. And at this time, I never really thought I had. I knew I drank differently than other people. I knew I was having troubles with the drugs. I knew I was completely depressed and didn't want to live and didn't know what my future was, what my path was going to be. But I never thought I was really an alcoholic, or I didn't think I was a drug addict, or I didn't think any of those things. Because I, at that time, I always thought those guys were the bums on the street with a brown paper bag. And I was not that, but I was pretty desperate and pretty struggling. So we're going through the whole process to get her into treatment. And we were there for a couple hours, and this guy said, "Glenn, I'd like you to come into the room over here. We're going to talk to you about some things." And I thought, all right, well, I'm going to go find out like how to support my ex-wife and go through this whole process. When we were in there, they said, "We have a bed for you." And I looked at him. I said, "You have what?" I said, "There's no way in hell I'm going into any bed. I don't have a problem. I'm not doing this." And he says, "Well," and then he kept me in there for a while. And he was a really a good guy and kind of went through his story. And it was somewhat similar to mine in some ways. And I kind of related to him. What I ended up doing was I agreed to going to outpatient. And I told him that I would try to go to some of those meetings and see what I could do about that. Well, I left the treatment. She stayed in there. I leave and I go to my first meeting and then my first group. And I started to read. I just became a sponge, Mark. I read so many books. Any book that anyone would give me about recovery, about self-help, I just was a sponge. I just started reading it like crazy. And after leaving that treatment center, the Super Bowl in 1994, she was in treatment. I was at home alone, and I ended up starting to drink before the game, and I was all by myself. I ended up drinking like a case and a half that night watching the game. I woke up the next morning. I'm like, I have a serious problem. And so then I went to a meeting with another guy and realized that I was at that point. I've got to give this a try. And I did. And that was the last day I had anything to drink. And I just soaked up every bit of knowledge I could find on how to get better. And the funny thing was, is I'm in kind of this, I have a really crappy job. I was selling fitness equipment for peanuts and had a little tiny house in Milwaukee, had lost everything, had gone through a divorce. We were actually divorced when all this was going on, but we were still trying to pull it together. And I'm sitting down and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? Well, a guy called me and said, "Would you come coach a football camp?" So I did. At that camp, all these guys were there and they said they were working at this facility helping kids. And they said, "Would you like to come work with us?" Because I was telling them how I hated my job. I was like, "Sure." So I go apply there and get the job. And I'm there about a year, Mark. And my yearly salary was the same amount as my 1 week check at New Orleans. And I was thinking, I'm happier now doing this than I was when I was playing football, and this is blowing me away. And at the time, all of a sudden, I kind of realized that when I was down in New Orleans, I went and saw a psychologist that he had come and said he was offering free service to do some testing on guys. And after the testing, I'm sitting there, and he said to me, he goes, "Glenn, you are not an NFL football player." And I looked at him. I said, "You're crazy. I got a contract. I'm playing, blah, blah, blah." And he says, "No, what I mean is that's not what your purpose is." He said, "Your purpose is to go try and help other people, probably teenagers, but you have a gift and you have an ability to help other people." Well, this was way back when I was in New Orleans, and I kind of blew it off like, whatever. Well, here I am working at a residential treatment center helping kids, and I'm the happiest I've ever been in my whole entire life. And it was just, it blew me away that this guy, this testing or whatever he did, figured out what my purpose was. So then I started really paying attention to what my purpose is. And that was taking what had happened to me, all the things that I had gone through, and trying to help other people deal with their issues, similar to some people that had helped me along the way as well. So that's kind of how I got into where I was after the whole drug thing and alcohol. And once you find your purpose, it's so much easier to not have that desire or that need to have drugs and alcohol.
Yeah. I mean, boy, I can sure identify with a lot of those things you just said. And I mean, certainly wherever your focus is, your energy always follows, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
And so rather than focused on, hey, let's go out and get a bunch of beers, and you go down that path, that rabbit hole, you're going off to saying, you know, there are kids. And the other thing about that too is that by nature, we are all social creatures, right? We weren't put on this earth to be in solitude. Some people choose that, but for the most of us, where you're starting to really get that gratitude is not about being the, and we all have to be this way, I was this way, the selfish NFL player, that you're just trying to be the best that you can be. Now you're turning around and going out and you're helping others get through their problems. And then the other point of that, like this whole podcast for me, I don't think in my time on this earth, my podcast would be nearly as effective as they are today, mainly because of what I've gone through in the past, right? Mm-hmm. And there's been ups and there's been a whole lot of downs. This has happened to me. I've been divorced and, you know, a lot of heartache that goes along with that. And unlike you, I've been, you know, I was drafted and I was cut and I was picked back up and all these different things happen. And over life, the journey of life that ensues puts you in a position for this little thing called perspective.
Yes.
And at that point in time, now you're able to look back and impart that knowledge based on people who are going through this stuff. So even though that was, you know, it was awful and you had to go through all that, and I'm so sorry that you got to that such a low point that you wanted to end your life, but from out of that sorrow comes joy, right? And you're able to really convey that message to those who are open to receiving it. That is a gift. And
it,
you
is,
know,
it is.
Congratulations.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
thank
that's
you.
So awesome for you. Yeah. No, yeah. It's great.
Yeah. It was nothing, you know, when people talk about how you dreamed as a kid to play in the NFL. Well, when I did, man, that was my goal. That's what I wanted to do. And when I was there, it didn't feel like the dream that I was thinking it would be. Partly due to the addiction, but also partly due to, I think we glorify so many things in our world. And we say, oh, if I could only get to that. When what you said earlier is so true, is helping others, being a social creature, being able to be a small part in someone's life. Like I work with football players. I also work with teenage drug addicts. I work with adults as well, some, but just to be a small piece and have a kid who is now an adult who has kids be able to send me a message on Facebook and say, hey, Glenn, if it hadn't been for you, I would have never been married and had a kid and loved my life. It's what I would like to see more people realize, that that's the dream. I mean, that's what we need to work at, is to become the type of people that can help others so that they can be successful, be happy, be productive. That's where the dream is.
Well, there's, you know, look, we all need to have that angel on our shoulders, right?
Yeah.
And you mentioned just a little while ago where you're kind of in this low spot, but then somebody said, hey, Glenn, come over and have a look at this thing that we're doing at the center for kids to help them get back on their feet.
Right.
So for you, that might have been that person. And then you become that person,
right,
to go and encourage and cheer and coach and impart your knowledge and experience on all these other ones to possibly change their life. And that's just, you know, if you're just out there changing one person's life, that's the game changer. And that's
it
what it's all about, right?
Yep. And I think back, you know, on Dave McLean, our head coach, I think he was one of those coaches that impacted so many guys that are great people in this world right now. And I think Jim Mora did to a degree. I think there's a lot of coaches that are out there that are doing that. And there's players out there doing it. Stan Brock is a guy that I look at.
Sure.
Who has a lot of great messages to tell. And I listen to Howie Long. I listen to, you know, a lot of these great Kevin Zeitler. Great NFL guys that are talking and actually out there helping others. And I do believe that they feel probably as good as when some of their accolades from the playing days, when they see these other people actually getting help and getting better through some of the stuff that they do. It's awesome. I love it.
Yeah, no, it's the full circle of life. And we all have to go through our own journey, and it has a lot of zigs and zags that are in there for all of us. And I don't think there's anybody on the planet given enough time that hasn't gone through something. And if you haven't gone through something, then you're lying. And so it's just a matter of, are you willing to stand up and say, this is what happened to me? And everybody's got varying degrees, you know, and it's perspective again, too. I mean, you had an awful or a very challenging time growing up and then getting into some of these different things that happened to you. But at the same time, you know, I've interviewed guys with no arms and legs and or blind, and there's just so many other situations. Like, well, I had that, but at least I didn't have this, right? It's one of those things.
It can always, always, always be worse, and it can always, always, always be better. Dave McLean used to say this like 5 million times, and I got sick of hearing it, but now it's one of the things that comes to me all the time. He said, in life, you never can stay the same. You either get better or you get worse. You can't stay the same. It's impossible. And he's right.
And I say it a little bit differently, but it's the same message, which is if you're not growing, you're dying.
Exactly. So, yes. Yep. Same message. Thing. Yep.
So tell me, Glenn, what exactly, and you may have mentioned this a minute ago, but I want to just really drill down. What are you doing exactly today then?
Well, it's interesting. I went through in sobriety. When you're out and using, you know, you make the statements like, well, my marriage was a disaster because I was using. My first marriage was, and that was probably a lot of, and unfortunately, my first wife passed away a couple of years ago from breast cancer, but she and I had talked a little bit, you know, once in a while we would talk about, well, what if? And it never, obviously, we never got back together. I was married and she was married to other people, and you kind of blame the alcohol. Well, I'm in a marriage in sobriety and we're having a lot of issues, and it ended up, we have two beautiful daughters, and there were a lot of things that went on that I'm not going to go into specifically, but we ended up getting to the point where we had a divorce, and here you are in sobriety. So it kind of like, you know, you talk about the things happen in circles, and you always have things that come into your life that change you. Well, at this time, I had built a school. I had added on to our agency a huge division, education division, and helping kids, help thousands of kids. Was going very well. The economy took kind of a turn for the worse, and a lot of money went out of the state. Our state funding went away. And so some of our programs were dying. And my position was one that was kind of created by me because of the programs that I set up. And it was starting to fade a little bit. And I was trying to go in some different directions and having a really difficult time in my personal life. So long story short is I'm going through a divorce, and I also lose my job of almost 20 years. And the only thing keeping me going, Mark, from going back to using and from staying afloat was my two daughters. I knew I had to be a father for them. I knew I had to figure something out. But at the same time, I also learned that if you don't take care of yourself and if you don't feed yourself the things that you need to have, you're going to be live a miserable existence. And I didn't want to have that for my daughters, and I didn't want to have that for myself. So I started to really take a look at what direction and what do I need to do. When I left the NFL, I could not stand the game of football. I hated it. I avoided it. I didn't go to any games, watch anything on TV. I pretty much just left it. After a few years, though, I started to miss it and got back into coaching and started looking at it from a different perspective, started remembering all the things the coaches taught me that the game teaches you for your life skills. And that started to fuel my fire. It's like, okay, you know what? I didn't get to where I wanted to be for the game of football, but it wasn't the game of football's fault. That was my fault. It was where I was going. So what can I do to help other people, to help try and find out where my purpose is and where I can help the most people? I still enjoy working with kids that have come through really rough situations, but I've loved the last few years coaching kids in football and teaching the life skills that I learned and teaching them how serious that these skills can really change your direction that you go in. So a guy that used to play at Wisconsin, he's quite a bit younger than me, but he and I hooked up and we started a business coaching offense and defensive linemen. And we basically, our whole philosophy is to help the big kids stay in the game, help them learn how to play the O-line the way we played it back in our day. With the way the offenses are changing, there's so much, they're going away from the traditional kind of tough guy line play to doing this spread offense and just telling the kids, just stay in front of them. They're not teaching them and I've also watched the NFL now, you know, and the college and everything. And they're saying, the coaches in the NFL are saying that the college kids coming out are taking a year or two before they're even able to play in the NFL because they don't play football in college the way the NFL does. So the guys are not prepared and ready to go into the NFL and play the way they need to play. And I'm blessed to know the head coach at Wisconsin real well. Him and I played together. And I actually coached with his father I was with him when he died at Platteville. And Wisconsin does a great job of teaching their O-line and D-line the way it needs to be. And that's why there's so many offensive linemen from Wisconsin playing in the NFL right now. And so Steve and I, my partner, we're trying to carry that down to the youth kids and teach them the proper way of playing the game so that they can play it like they do in the Wisconsin, Alabamas, Iowas, and those places that are producing linemen that are going in the NFL. So we started a business a couple years ago, and it's been fun. It's been challenging, but it's been rewarding, and we're really working hard to get it off the ground, and I've really enjoyed it. I may go back into, I've got a job opportunity possibly that I might go back into a residential facility and work with some troubled kids again, but I'm kind of enjoying just raising my girls, watching them play basketball and volleyball, and helping kids through coaching football.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Where can people find you?
Best place would be go to our website, which is trenchtraining.com. Trench as in digging a trench, training, it's all one word, .com. And we have...
That's where the linemen love to live, right?
They love to live in the trenches, yeah. You know, either love it or you don't. And I tell kids all the time, you know, it's one of those things that this isn't a sometime deal. You either want to be it or you don't. And if you do, you're going to love it and you're going to have fun. If you don't, maybe you need to find another, you know, something else to do. I don't like to force kids into it, but I also don't like to have kids just quit because they aren't getting taught the correct way and they're not feeling part of and being with and learning the whole love of being an offensive and defensive lineman. It's a great fraternity. I mean, you know, you have it with your wide receivers and that, but I think the linemen kind of have a fraternity that's a little different than a lot of other positions, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, there's no question. You guys, your own breed of cat. Totally, totally appreciate that. So, well, listen, Glenn, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for opening up and sharing your story. And we're all on a journey. It never ends, as you know, and you've been certainly one to be on that path, and it's great. And I feel, you know, like I'm a better person because I heard your story. And again, it's all about perspective, and a lot of the things you talked about I've experienced, and we're just still trying to, you know, take one step in front of the other, kind of the mountain cliche of trying to get to that summit. And then what's the next summit? And that's all part of the journey.
Well, I really appreciate it, Mark. I've been honored that you invited me on here, and I've watched a lot of what you've done, and it's all awesome, awesome stuff. So I'm glad to be a part of it.
Much appreciated. All right. Listen, have a great day and a great holiday down in Wisconsin.
Yep. There you go. All right. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, bud. Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. If you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.